Fox News Radio.
On Wall Street, the Dow's down 10 points. It was up over 100 earlier. I'm Dave Anthony, Fox News Radio.
Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling is a live call-in radio program providing doctrinal dialogue, cultural commentary, and insightful interviews with some of today's foremost Christian authors and leaders. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Traveler's Rest. The goal of the church and the radio program is to seek the glory of God in the salvation of sinners and the sanctification of the saints by the ministry of the Word. For more information, go to www.knowingthetruth.org. Here with today's edition of Knowing the Truth is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome into this edition of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast. This is Pastor Kevin Bowling. So glad that you joined us on the broadcast today. By the way, yesterday we talked about an important issue that is a national issue, but it had a lot of local repercussions. And the repercussions here locally were because the topic was about U.S. Islamic charter schools. So this is taking place across the country, 135 Islamic charter schools being opened up as part of what's called the Gulen Movement. And on the broadcast yesterday, we talked about that. But it had a local element to it as well, because there was a local charter school that's opening up under that same group. It's part of that, appears to be, although many of them, if not all of them, deny that they're part of it, it appears to be opening up under that same group. A group called, this one's called the Green Charter School, opening up on Pelham Road. I mentioned that because that program yesterday has received a lot of interest. We're approaching now 200 downloads since the program yesterday, and so a lot of folks passing that around on Facebook and social media, and it's out there for download, free download, on sermonaudio.com. By the way, on sermonaudio.com, we are broadcasting live again with a live webcast, video webcast out on Sermon Audio. Jim is back, and so Jim is doing that. I couldn't do it yesterday. I had a lot of information to cover. I didn't think I'd be able to shuffle through all that information and do the video piece as well. So good to have Jim back in the studio here doing the video piece. If you want to watch the program then, you can go out there to sermonaudio.com/knowingthetruth, and you'll be able to click there and watch the live webcast out there right now as we're talking about some more important issues on the broadcast today. Two issues that we're going to be dealing with. These are two big national issues that are taking place. We're going to look at them from a Christian worldview perspective. The first issue is about data collection. Many of you know about the NSA and what has been taking place with the NSA, and they're basically spying upon the American people. I think that's what separates the spying that took place under the Bush administration and what started with the Patriot Act and what's taking place now under the Obama administration. The difference is that in the original form, it was mostly foreigners that were being spied upon. Some of those foreign conversations were taking place, were routed through the U.S., and because they were routed through the U.S., the U.S. government achieved the ability to listen in and to capture the data associated with those phone calls. Now, data collection is been happening, and it's an information technology item where they take that data then that's collected, and you can look for certain patterns in that data. You can mine the data and look for certain items and certain patterns that are there. What we find out now from the NSA is that this has been happening on a much broader scale under the Obama administration than people anticipated, especially since Barack Obama ran on this policy of openness, of transparency, and that what Bush was doing was wrong. And now we find out that he has taken this program, it's put it on steroids, and now it's been much, much, much more pervasive, and it is basically collecting the calling data of almost all of the American people, certainly all that were on Verizon. Can you hear me now? I think is the statement that's coming out. Well, our lead interview here today is going to be with Daniel James Devine. He's a reporter for World Magazine, and he did a story on the person who broke this story. His name is, he's a former CIA employee called, his name is Edward Snowden. And the leak that he let out revealed information about a program called PRISM, which is used by the NSA, the National Security Agency, to secretly obtain emails, documents, audio and video files. I guess they could be checking up on us right now since we've got both those audio and video files going out. And all of those from major internet companies like Apple and Google and so forth. And so we'll talk with him about that in just a few moments. And even more specifically about this Edward Snowden. We'll talk with him about him personally. Is he a sinner or a saint? You know, is he a hero or is he a traitor? That's what people are wondering about today. In the second half of the program, we're going to talk about another important countrywide domestic issue that has taken place, and that deals with the subject of Common Core educational standards. We'll be joined on that part of the program, that segment, by Lindsay Burke. She's a researcher, and she writes on federal and state education issues for the Heritage Foundation. So Lindsay will be joining us on the second half of the program to bring us up to speed on what is Common Core. Is it good or bad? Again, is it, you know, should we stand up against this? Should we expose it and oppose it? Or should we be embracing it? That's what we'll find out from Lindsay on the second half of the program. So let's go to the phone line. Daniel, it's great to have you back on the Knowing the Truth radio program.
Hi, Kevin. Great to be here.
Daniel, tell us, first of all, about, give a little bit of an intro there. Tell us about what's been taking place via data collection and the information gathering source of the NSA, and then we'll move from there to talk about what's happened with this former CIA employee, and then we can talk a little bit deeper about him, Edward Snowden himself. So let's start with, 30,000-foot view here of what's taking place with the NSA.
Yeah, as you kind of mentioned in your intro, the National Security Agency, which is the government's code-making and code-breaking agency, as they like to call themselves, they are collecting data on, for one thing, U.S. phone calls, just collecting records and information such as the duration of the calls, what numbers are being called, and sort of compiling that in a massive database that they can search when they need to for investigations. And on top of that, they're actually collecting data from U.S. Internet companies, Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, Facebook, Skype, which is a phone service where you can actually see video and talk over the Internet that way. And they have access in some way to these companies to be able to pull data from them if they're conducting an investigation on a what they call a foreign target. Mm. Now, these foreign targets are people who would be like suspects in a terrorism case. But what happens is when the NSA investigates these people, they'll also investigate their contacts, who they're talking with. And they may even look at the contacts. And so, you know, from there it kind of spreads out in a circle. And so if somebody in the U.S. is talking to a suspect or maybe to a contact of a suspect, they could get swept up in these kind of investigations too, and without ever them knowing it.
Is this related, Daniel, then to the AP scandal that was taking place where the government was listening in on phone calls that some of the reporters were making? Is that kind of another element here or a completely different scandal?
Similar in some ways. I mean, it was, you know, the same idea is that they're listening on, you know, on phone calls and or they may not have been listening on phone calls in that case. I think they were just actually collecting the phone records, such as we've recently heard in Verizon. So that aspect of it is the same. One thing that's different is that in the AP case, they were not investigating like a terrorism activity, but they were investigating a leak of classified material. So that may have been a little bit different. That may have been more like a domestic criminal investigation.
Mm-hmm. The reason why I brought that up was when you were talking about that it tends to have this ripple effect so that it's not just the person in the context that they're making, but then it goes out broader. I remember the person there that they were listening in on from Fox News, it ended up that they were then listening in on his parents' phone calls, and that they ended up even listing him as a co-conspirator at one point. That was the heading, that the category that they had put him in order to obtain the proper authority to be able to listen in on those phone calls. So that's where I was making the connection. Obviously, on listening or gathering all of this data, one of the elements that seems to be problematic about this is everybody wants to be safe, right? So we're okay with that concept that efforts are underway to keep everybody safe. But one of the things that we saw, like we're seeing with the other scandal with the IRS, it's tough to keep our scandals straight here. But anyways, with the other scandal with the IRS, that this data could be used politically against the current administration's enemies, right? So we don't know how this data is actually, how it's being guarded or who has access to it and all of this type of information. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, that's always the scary thing. I mean, when we talk about the government collecting, you know, massive amounts of data on Americans, and then, of course, they say, well, we're using it very carefully. We're only using it for specific investigations. But yet when they're not telling you exactly how they're using it, because they say, well, it's classified, then, I mean, in the back of my mind, that does raise red flags. I would like to know exactly what the government knows about me, mm-hmm. and, you know, how they're going to use it in the future. Now, there is there's a special court called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court that is supposed to be providing oversight for these kinds of investigations. And that court has existed for a long time, but a lot of privacy groups are very concerned about how that court interprets federal laws and how that court is broadly giving the government authority to conduct the kind of surveillance that's been in the news the last few days.
And again, the key word there is foreign intelligence. What we've discovered here, that it's not like it was in the Bush administration where they were trying to listen to phone calls just between it could be a U.S. citizen and a foreign source, but all the phone calls, right, from major providers and primarily now domestically. So it's really expanded from what it was in the beginning.
Yeah, and it sounds pretty broad, and I haven't, you know, I don't know that they're collecting phone records of every single call in the United States, but it certainly sounds like they have that capability. And I think the argument that they're making is, well, we collect all this data, but we only actually search the data if we have an investigation. But I'm not sure it really puts my mind at rest.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the fellow that's at the center of the recent revelations. You start your article out by saying, after leaking a set of PowerPoint slides that disclosed a massive United States government electronic spying program, former Central Intelligence Agency employee Edward Snowden asked the reporter to reveal his identity. Now, I personally feel that he should be arrested, not so much for what he did, but just for using PowerPoint still, or the government should be in trouble because they're still using that program after all of these years. I'm joking. Of course, now there's a lot of debate taking place. I was listening to some of it this morning as I was coming into the studio. There's a lot of debate taking place whether or not he should be looked at as a sinner or a saint, whether he's a national hero or whether this man is a traitor. I was just listening to something on the web from Ron Paul, and Ron Paul was saying that the president should call and congratulate him because the president ran on a platform of transparency, and this was just transparency. So speak to that issue. You write now about him personally and what he did and the way he's being looked at here. Bring our listeners up to speed as to what you wrote about in your article.
Yeah, Edward Snowden, he's 29 years old, and he's a former employee of the CIA. So he's had dealings with classified information for a long time. It's just been his career. And after working for the CIA, he became a defense contractor, and he had access to classified files. And so that's how he got this information that he leaked to a couple of newspapers recently. And the reason that he said he did that is he was becoming very concerned about the growth of the state and the ability of the government to spy on internet and phone activity.
Mm-hmm.
So he turned over these classified documents, and as most people have already heard, of course, those documents are the ones that revealed this whole phone data collection thing with Verizon, and also the spying on internet activity.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's so fascinating about this is, like you said, there's this debate going on about whether he should be called a traitor or a hero. And literally people are calling him both on both sides of the debate. And really this debate is fascinating. That's really just transcending, the traditional Democrat-Republican boundaries, because you have people on both sides who are either defending him or who are criticizing him.
Mm-hmm.
John Bolton, John Boehner, Mitch McConnell have all called for him to, be held accountable for what he's done. And then you have others like, Ron Paul, and then there's also Democrats who are defending him for the leak that he's made, calling him a hero.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a difficult issue, of course, because we do have national security secrets that need to remain secret on the one hand, and so we can't just have every employee leaking stuff out left and right. But on the other hand, when somebody does leak something that surprises us to the extent of government intrusion in our lives, it's a little bit harder for us to criticize them like I think we otherwise would.
Well, your article is entitled Whistleblower or Defector. Why couldn't he release some of this information or go the channel that is legal for him to do, which is the whistleblower program? You know, that they can do that without violating laws. There's ways, there's a channel there to be able to do that. Why didn't he do it that way? Why did he decide to do it in this way where he appears to be a defector?
Yeah, that's a good question. As I understand it, the whistleblower laws only apply to instances where he's revealing illegal activity,
mm-hmm.
or activity that is fraudulent. And so these programs are, according to what the government says, these programs are actually done with legal authority under the Patriot Act and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. There was nothing illegal that was occurring here. Even if it was secret, even if it surprises us, it was illegal, and so they would not consider this to be a case of whistleblowing, but a case of leaking state secrets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm of the persuasion that just because we like the data that he released doesn't make it, shouldn't eliminate that it's a crime to release the data. When he signed up for the job and when he got the clearance, he agreed that he would not do that, you know. So for him to, even though I may like that exposed and might even like a little bit more that it's damaging to the Obama administration, that type of thing, I still can't find myself saying, well, yeah, but what he did is acceptable and something that we should condone, and especially not look on the guy as being a hero for doing something along this line. You mentioned in your article that we even have now, people have started a Pardon Edward Snowden White House petition program that's going, and it already, at the time of your article, had 16,000 people, signatures that had already signed up for it, so people are already talking about pardoning him. I think, you know, it's a little bit of a rush here to judgment. I want to know a little bit more about him, but on the surface, my first thing is, that's against the law, and I don't want people just releasing national secrets because they determine in and of themselves that, you know, something, this is something that they don't care for, and therefore they're going to go ahead and release it. What is your take on that? And tell us a little bit more about the idea of people now coming to his defense.
Yeah, well, the petition you mentioned is actually, I'm checking it right now, it's actually up to almost 62,000 signatures. So he does have a lot of people on his side. I mean, of course, there are always going to be people who are going to support leakers like this, no matter what information is revealed. But I agree that you know, we can't have employees just leaking information left and right that could be damaging to our national security. At the same time, I think that the issues that some privacy groups are raising over the extent of government surveillance are legitimate, and they're worth asking questions about. Mm-hmm. And there's at least one group, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, that is has sued the federal government to try to learn some more information about the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which gives approval to this type of surveillance activity, in order for them to just reveal a little more of their thinking on what type of surveillance they approve, because the hitch with that particular court is that actually all of its decisions are kept secret, so we really don't know exactly what the kind of surveillance the government is allowed to do and how they justify it, which seems like it would be nice as Americans for us to just at least know the extent of surveillance that's going on.
Mm-hmm. As of right now, the the latest on this young man is that he is still in Hong Kong, and you know, kind of he says that he's not going to defect to China or something like that. But he's gonna. As of today, from what I heard, he said that he has kind of submitted himself to the whatever the Hong Kong authorities say to do with them, and I guess we do have an extradition treaty with them, and so that process may start. But I'm not so sure if he should be the focus of it as much as, at this point, the information that was released. Right or wrong, it's out there now, and so now we've got to deal with whether this PRISM program that you talk about in your article, which is the software that's being used in order to gather this data, you know, whether this has just gone way too far, and now listening in on so many domestic calls, or at least the data from the calls, whether or not that's right. You know, Jay Leno said the other night, he said, you know, we wanted a president that would listen to all the American people. Well, now we've got one. He's apparently listening to everybody. So in your final statement here, you know, just wrapping up the interview, where do we go from here?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we need to keep asking the questions and just keep it in front of our president, both this president and the one afterwards, because these programs are certainly going to go on for a while. Keep it in front of them that as Americans, you know, we want to know the extent of government surveillance. As technology grows, as it evolves, we just want our elected officials to know that they're accountable for these things, and they need secrecy in order to do their jobs, and we understand that. But we just want to make sure that they don't go too far in either direction.
Mm-hmm. I guess, you know, we just have to weigh these things very carefully as to what was right or wrong, you know, when information should be released and when it shouldn't. I mean, we could always use the example of folks in Hitler's regime or something saying, you know, is it should somebody have spoken up about what was taking place with the Jews and so forth? And obviously people would then say, well, that would be a case where people should have. But we have to judge, are we at that point, and you know, what should be released? It's a lot of ethical questions here, I think, on the whole piece, and we really need to do some soul searching to decide, you know, just what should be done and what shouldn't. But Daniel, thank you so much for writing this article and helping us to think through these issues and bringing us the information to be able to do that. We better cut it here. The NSA doesn't have as much storage as they had before. And so listening in on this conversation now, we better just end it here. What do you think?
Sounds good. Thanks for having me again.
All right, Daniel. Thanks so much. That was Daniel James Devine. Writing for World Magazine. He's a reporter for World Magazine. You can go out and check out his articles, and specifically the one we were talking about today called Whistleblower or Defector, and you can check that out on worldmag.com. That's www.worldmag.com. We're going to be joined in just a couple minutes. We're going to switch gears just slightly, but we're going to talk about another important issue here in the country with Lindsay Burke. Lindsay does research and writes on federal and state education issues for the Heritage Foundation, and we're going to talk about Common Core education standards. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. For more information about today's program, the radio ministry, and the resources we offer, go to www.knowingthetruth.org.
I hope you never miss a single edition of the Mike Huckabee Show. Oh, yeah, we get into politics and talk to the newsmakers every single day. They want to be on our show because they know we'll talk to them straight and clear. But it's not just people who are in politics. We talk to folks from the entertainment industry. We do movie reviews. We try to make sure that we cover all the landscape of politics and culture. Join us every day on the Mike Huckabee Show.
Weekday afternoons from noon to 3 on Christian Talk 660 and 92.9 FM.
It's a war of words. This is Ken Ham, author, speaker, and blogger on the topic of science and the Bible. Human language is causing confusion among evolutionists. You see, some evolutionists are asking why humans would supposedly evolve a system of language that can prevent them from communicating with each other. Now, biblical creationists have an explanation. The Bible says that humanity shared a common language until the incident of the Tower of Babel. Genesis chapter 11 tells us that man desired to build a single civilization instead of spreading across the earth as God had commanded. Seeing this, God confused their languages and scattered the people over the face of the earth, slowing the spread of ungodliness. You know, the history found in the Bible clearly explains the origin of languages. We can trust God's word.
You'll find out more about the Tower of Babel when you visit AnswersInGenesis.org and check out our future full-size Noah's Ark. That's AnswersInGenesis.org.
Today, nearly half our nation's fighting forces are members of the Guard and Reserve. When they are called to active duty, they leave behind a family, a community, and a job. Employer support of the Guard and Reserve, a Department of Defense agency, honors and protects the bond between service members and their civilian employers. Whether serving our country or supporting those who do, we all serve. To learn more about ESGR, call 1-800-336-4590 or visit esgr.mil.
Welcome back to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Information regarding the resources referenced on today's program can be found at www.knowingthetruth.org. Now, here to continue with today's program is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Okay, the last conversation that we were just in with Daniel Devine from World Magazine about the NSA and the data gathering that was taking place, it's got the studio here all in a, it's buzzing in here with, well, I'm not sure if we should listen or we shouldn't listen and all of these things. So I think this is an important issue, is that the people of the United States need to consider carefully, and something that we need to look at the ethical aspects of it. And, you know, dealing with the Fourth Amendment is important. And so we need to carefully consider these things. And so that's what we're trying to do on the last segment on the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast here. I want to look at another issue now that may be equally as controversial. Whenever we talk about education, of course, in this country, there's people on both sides of this issue. Some people say, well, we need broad-based educational standards. One of the reasons why they think that this is good is then no matter where you are in the country, the same basic educational standards are being applied. So we travel a lot now as Americans, much more than we did many years ago. It's not uncommon to go to school in one region, and then but you're going to take a job in a completely different area of the country. And so we need some sort of educational standards that are good across all the state boundaries and so forth. So there's their push on it. Others say, wait a second, you know, this idea of the centralized education top-down standards that are being given to us really ignore the uniqueness of the child and the uniqueness of the area in which they're being taught. It removes all that, and we don't have the flexibility that is necessary there. You're taking away the choice in education and these types of things. So we've got a debate that is raging on this particular issue in our country, and it all centers around something called Common Core Educational Standards. Joining me now on the program is Lindsay Burke. Lindsay does research, and she writes on federal and state education issues for the Heritage Foundation, and she specifically has written an article out on heritage.org about this issue. It appeared in their Morning Bell issue or place on their website, segment of their website, and she says, join the fight against Common Core. So I wanted to get Lindsay on the program here to discuss why is she against this and why is she advocating basically in that article that people should also be against it as well. Lindsay, welcome back to the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast.
Thanks for having me.
Lindsay, we better start by telling people what is Common Core and where is it currently? Is it about to be passed? Is legislation about to come down? So if you could tell us those two things to start off, and then we can look at, you know, whether people should be for it or against it.
Well, you know, you mentioned that this is something people are beginning to debate, and I only wish this debate had started before states decided to adopt Common Core.
Mm.
Unfortunately, most states adopted Common Core national standards sight unseen, certainly with very little parental input or input from teachers, and they did so because the Obama administration offered some pretty significant incentives for states to adopt.
Mm.
So early on, we saw as Common Core first really came out, which was early 2009, we saw the administration at the same time offer Race to the Top grants. Now, Race to the Top is a competitive grant program. It offered about $4.3 billion to states, but states only had access to that money if they agreed to adopt standards that were common to a significant number of other states.
Hmm.
Well, Common Core was the only game in town that met that criteria and remains so today. So that $4.3 billion was a major incentive, and now we see the administration offering waivers from No Child Left Behind, which is, of course, very enticing to states. And then the administration has also directly financed the National Testing Consortia that will test whether students have learned what Common Core standards put out.
Now, when we're saying Common Core, are we talking about a Common Core of subjects, or are we talking about a Common Core of subject matter? In other words, you know, are we saying, okay, you have to teach history, you have to teach science, and there's this basically these categories that have to be taught in the school and in a school in order to be part of, you know, the school system as a whole. Is that what we're talking about, or are we talking about some very specific details on what needs to be taught in each one of those categories?
Unfortunately, it's the latter, that these are very specific requirements, and it's math and English standards So what Common Core does is it sets basically national standards or uniform standards, if you want to think about it that way,
mm-hmm.
for what every public school will teach in terms of their mathematics and English language arts subjects. And so you have standards for both of those subjects being put out. So these are standards that run from kindergarten through 12th grade.
Hmm. Would it basically result in a national curriculum?
Well, that's the fear among many conservatives, and quite frankly, among many people across the spectrum, that when you have standards, these are certainly standards that are set at the national level, and now you have tests that are set at the national level. Many schools are already beginning to align their textbook purchases with those standards, to align their teacher professional development with those standards. And so you can see how you have the standards, the assessments, the professional development, the textbooks, all of these items end up sort of dictating and forming curriculum. Mm. And so there is a concern that this will morph into a national curriculum, which is prohibited in three federal laws, but I think we're getting somewhat close to seeing that statutory prohibition breached.
Hmm. So there already are laws on the books preventing a centralized approach to education across the country.
In a nutshell, that's right. But what we're seeing now is a sort of backdoor effort to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
The Race to the Top program, that $4 billion that I mentioned earlier, was carved out of the so-called stimulus grant that was put out back
mm-hmm.
in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of this has happened. The waivers from No Child Left Behind in particular, outside of the normal legislative process.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the administration right now pushing for another reauthorization of No Child Left Behind. And when that didn't happen on their sort of arbitrary timeline, decided to begin offering waivers to states. But, of course, those waivers were contingent upon a state like South Carolina agreeing to adopt the White House's preferred education policies, one of which were national standards and tests.
Hmm. Always follow the money, right?
Right.
And there's the gift that keeps on giving, that stimulus program that keeps popping up
yeah.
in all of these unexpected areas. Well, let's talk then about why this consolidated federal approach to education is such a bad thing. Why is a centralized approach bad versus a more localized approach to education?
Well, I think at its essence, it's really this notion that centralization is superior to competition. And I think we've seen in every other aspect of American life that that's not the case. And we wouldn't quite frankly tolerate it mm. in any other aspect of our lives. And I think something as important as education, what our children are being taught, should certainly not be subjected to these centralization whims or the whims of bureaucrats in Washington.
Mm.
And you mentioned earlier that you have this push in part because people have this idea that children move around frequently,
mm-hmm.
and you want a child in Alabama to learn the same thing as a child in New York, or at least have that sort of fluency in standards when they move from state to state.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's interesting is that the American Community Survey that comes out every year, the 2011 was the most recent one we have, showed that less than 2% of children move from state to state. So this idea that you have sort of mass migration from state to state of students, I think, is actually a little off the mark. But it is, you're right, one of those areas where proponents of national standards often turn to is to say that we want that continuity of standards.
Mm-hmm. And there is some continuity, right? Because
there
we're
is.
Talking they took the subjects itself. Again, the devil seems to be in the details as to exactly what gets taught and being forced to teach it according to a federal standard with no flexibility on that whatsoever. But we're not talking about there's no standard there whatsoever. Is that correct?
That's right. States set their own state standards right now. And when you look at sort of the sequence of mathematics or English that's taught state to state, even though state standards vary, they're not all that different in terms of math sequences or English language arts. Now, states are going to teach their history standards differently to reflect state histories, but when it comes to subjects like English and math, we do see some consistency state to state. Now, what's missing in some instances might be transparency about student outcomes,
mm-hmm.
but we already have tests like the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which is a national but not federal assessment, basically a norm reference test to allow us to gauge how students are doing in states compared to students in other states. States often offer criterion reference tests, which allow us to determine how well a student has mastered state-level content, and the norm reference test to be able to tell how well your third grader compares to a third grader in California.
Mm-hmm.
So we already have all of these different assessment systems that are in place. If transparency is an issue about that data, that's another conversation, but it certainly doesn't merit nationalizing the content that's taught in schools across the country.
Hmm. You mentioned that the White House themselves are pushing this and doing it in this backdoor way, you know, tying it to funding and so forth. Is there other groups that are involved in pushing this? Is this something from the teachers' union in general? Are they in support of this?
Well, first of all, when it got started, it was the National Governors Association and the Council of Chief State Schools Officers. Those are the two groups that wrote the standards and really pushed it early on. And they're still the two groups that are most involved. But, as I said, early on, you also had the administration hop on board, both rhetorically and then with their financial support as well. The union issue is an interesting question. We've actually seen one of the larger teachers' union call for a halt in tying the stakes to the standards. And so basically, they don't want any sort of penalty, if you will, tied to the assessments at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So while they haven't come as far as to say, you know, these standards are bad or let's hold off on national standards, they've at least voiced concerns about the stakes that are tied to the assessments.
Hmm. I'm surprised to hear that because I would think that the Obama administration would line up pretty tightly with the teachers union. And so if there was any discussion there or divergence from one would say to the other would just surprise me. But you're saying that there is no single voice coming out of both of those two groups.
Yeah, and I think by and large they are supportive of this Common Core push. It's just a matter of what type of penalties are tied to the assessments down the road. So they've been rather nuanced in their critique of Common Core.
Mm. You have a great statement on in your article. It says educational choice is a revolution because it funds children instead of physical school buildings,
right,
and it allows the dollars to follow children to any school. Is that part of the issue here, that you know it's basically going to the school building rather than to actually helping the child and, you know, the education of the child even more specifically?
You know, I think that is at the heart of the problems that plague our education system today, is we have a system that is antiquated in terms of how it funds children. It funds physical school buildings, as you said. We fund institutions instead of funding kids. And if we shifted the way we think about public education funding and started to think in terms of funding the child and allowing that money to follow them to any school of choice, public, private, homeschooling, virtual, whatever meets their unique learning needs, I really believe we would see just a revolution happen. And that's how we're going to see improvements. It will be robust choice and competition, not the centralization that will come with Common Core that will ultimately improve outcomes.
I saw the one graphic that was put along with your article as well, and it included some of those same words that you just used. It says, for our listeners' sake, it says, every child is unique. Common Core education standards puts each child into one mold. So that's kind of, and then you play off the word choice a lot in your article here to talk about that Common Core removes the choice from parents and schools and so forth. The first item here, let me just get you to elaborate on it, but it says choice empowers parents. Fill that out a little bit, if you would, please.
Well, right now you have a situation where parents, by and large, only have choice if they can afford to finance both their public school system, by and large, to their local property taxes, and pay for private school tuition at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So you have some who would say choice is robust, but for those who can afford it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have so many families now that can't afford to pay both their local public school taxes and private school tuition.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we think about how we fund public education, it really does come back to that idea of, instead of funding those physical school buildings, to really give parents total control over the amount of money that is assigned to their child through the state system of funding education. One of the, I think, most innovative options to date that we've seen is in the state of Arizona. And what Arizona did, when this just started in 2011, is they established something called education savings accounts. So you can think of sort of a health savings account.
Mm-hmm.
So parents that are unhappy with their child's assigned public school can remove the child from the public school and have 90% of what the state would have spent deposited directly into their education savings account.
Mm-hmm.
What's unique is they can then use that money to pay for, say, a little private school tuition, a little online learning, maybe private tutoring at night, special education services, so they can totally customize their child's educational experience by directing their share of dollars. They can even roll over unused funds year to year, and they can even roll it into a college savings account down the road if they have money left over.
Mm.
So this is a unique approach to ed funding and has really served to empower parents.
Now, every time the idea of taking government money and allowing an education so that you can choose your own form of education, we talked about homeschooling a little bit or Christian schooling, the sticky point always comes up then, is the money, are there certain stipulations going to come along with the money? For instance, that if it's going to go towards a Christian school, is that then going to give the federal government a foothold into the, or a foot into the door of the Christian school to say, well, then you have to hire so many types of people and, you know, with everything else that's taking place? Is this a way, maybe through the these savings accounts, to be able to do it without those same requirements following the money?
Yeah, and you know, that's another good reason why it would be unwise to advocate for a federal voucher program.
Mm-hmm.
This is something states and localities finance 90% of all education spending. The federal government's just a 10% stakeholder. So any school choice options, whether it be vouchers, tuition tax credit programs, education savings accounts, need to happen at the state and local level. And it's really important that as states sort of embrace this wonderful proliferation of choice, that they're very careful not to impose any regulations, unwise regulations, on the private school system or homeschooling system. But you're right, education savings accounts absolutely are crafted in a way that provides really limited regulation or over-regulation, as it were, on private schools.
Mm. In your second point, you talk about choice pressures public schools with the much-needed competitive atmosphere. So it would spur a competitive attitude across the public school system, which seems to, in many other cases, spur innovation, as you were talking about, and better quality of service. Where would charter schools or magnet schools fit into that equation?
Yeah, charter schools are a great sort of step on that school choice ladder and something that has provided just wonderful opportunities, educational opportunities for children. Charter schools are public schools, but they have far more flexibility over how they sort of direct their funding, their hiring and firing practices, their school day, the length of it. So they have far more control over those types of decisions than a traditional public school does. And as a result, we've really seen charter schools become innovative schools that have really been designed to meet the needs of their student populations. So that's something that has provided a great sort of piece of competitive pressure on the traditional public system.
Mm-hmm.
We have other really good evidence from states like Florida that when you have voucher programs or other school choice options in place, that as we see more and more school choice options come on board and as we see more and more private schools participating, that the competitive pressure that that places on the public system has actually, and we know this from empirical evaluations, led to improvements for the students who not only received a voucher, but who decided to remain in the public system as well.
Mm.
So when people say school choice is a rising tide that lifts all boats, that's actually true, and we know that from a robust body of empirical evidence.
Hmm. And talking about evidence there is little or no evidence, though, that Common Core is going to have the grandiose results that have been associated with it. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. These are not internationally benchmarked standards, and in fact, what's interesting is many people have pointed out that you'll hear people say things like, well, countries that outperform the United States have national standards. Well, if you look at all the countries that have national standards, and then you look at all of those that don't have national standards, you see the U.S. outperforming those that do and outperforming those that don't. There's just no correlation between having national standards and performance internationally. And so it's something that's really hard to isolate for these high-performing countries. Was it that they had national standards? Really hard to say. There's so many other factors that influence how they perform on international tests.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lindsay, you said in the beginning that you wish that people would have had this debate sooner and that some states have already adopted this. What should the listening audience do then? Has it been completely adopted and that train is already going in that direction? Or what should they do to find out more about this and get involved?
Well, I would say you have about a year that's really critical, the next 12 months, because the all of the federal grants and incentives that were tied to Common Core required adoption by the 2014-15 school year. And so we're seeing states now who may have won Race to the Top money or secured a No Child Left Behind waiver and who agreed to adopt Common Core really have some buyer's remorse about that decision. I think that is why we saw in Indiana a very wise decision to hit pause on Common Core implementation. They actually passed something called the Common Core Pause Bill. And so what they've done is they've said in Indiana that over the next 14 months, they're going to have their state office of management and budget assess how much Common Core adoption will cost taxpayers, and they will also determine whether or not Common Core standards are inferior or superior to their previous state standards. So determining the cost and the quality are two things, quite frankly, I think states that agree to adopt should have done before having agreed to adopt, but Indiana's made the wise decision to put off implementation for 14 months. And then can decide at that point whether or not they want to adopt. Pennsylvania has followed a similar path. We've seen in Michigan, they just decided to to not fund any additional Common Core spending at the state level. So there are quite a few things that states can consider doing to halt Common Core from moving further from here on out.
We only have a minute or so left, but I should know this, but I don't. Do you know what the status is in the state of South Carolina?
Well, South Carolina is so interesting because South Carolina, Governor Haley has been really great on this issue, and she had a great line that I heard a few years ago, her say that for every dollar the state takes from the federal government, it ties a hand behind its back. And, you know, I think she was spot on in that assessment. She had pointed out that South Carolina doesn't want to sell its standard-setting authority to Washington or to national organizations. Unfortunately, South Carolina did decide to adopt about 2 years ago, and shortly after that had started to sort of have some buyer's remorse and had thought about whether or not to pull out. Secretary Duncan actually publicly admonished the state of South Carolina for doing that and said that South Carolinians were searching for were conspiracy theorists in search of a conspiracy. So it's just a really interesting history of South Carolina and the Common Core.
Yeah,
you're still in Common Core right now, but have every opportunity to reconsider and pull out.
I guess we got a little bit of that here. But you just have to separate that out of what the facts are. And you certainly have done that for us at the Heritage Foundation and in your articles in particular. Lindsay, thank you so much for writing this article and for joining us on the Knowing the Truth radio program today.
Great. Well, thanks so much for having me.
Okay. That was Lindsay Burke. I mentioned that you can read her article out on the blog for Heritage organization. You can go out there for the website is www.heritage.org. That's www.heritage.org, and you can find out information out there. The article that we were referring to is called Joining the Fight Against Common Core, and again, it's written by Lindsay Burke. Hey, tomorrow on the broadcast, we're going to talk with Brian Molitor, who is worked along with other folks in order to create a video called Boy's Passage, Man's Journey. We're going to talk with him tomorrow about that subject. You won't want to miss it. It's going to be a great time here on the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast. Remember this. The Lord Jesus Christ said, He said, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. We'll see you next time, right here on Knowing the Truth.
You've been listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Traveler's Rest. For more information about the church and radio ministry, visit us on the web at knowingthetruth.org.
The opinions expressed on today's program are those of the announcers, their guests, and callers, and do not necessarily represent those of the staff and management of His Radio Network, the Radio Training Network, or Clear Channel Communications.
Christian Talk 660, WLFJ Greenville, Spartanburg, Anderson on AM 660, and now also on FM 92.9.